when you think about leadership, you need to be, in today's world, you know, flexible, adaptable to new information, to adjusting to where the puck is going, if you will.
Hi, team, and welcome to the CEO Podcast. This is a place where we will have conversations on culture and team chemistry. We will deconstruct why there actually is an I in team from the strategies and attributes of the highest impact people and teams out there, so that in turn, you can apply as tools in your life, business, and sports. My name and your host is Kevin Rutherford. I'm a CEO and leader by trade and training. I've directed teams to successful acquisition and exit while also creating recognized cultures where people want to work and play. So let's jump right into today's episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the Chief Eternal Optimist Podcast. And I'm joined here with my producer and director, Brian, and we're going to have some fun today. So let's go through some fun topics.
The first one that comes to mind is the incredible work of the Microsoft CEO who's been in the news lately. Let's talk about that one.
Satya Nadella.
Amazing.
Yes. I think he's been there for roughly a decade, 10 years. I think he's promoted from within, if I know his story right, if I got that correctly. You know, I'm going to just pause here and say that I was recently at a holiday party. And I connected with somebody that was working at Microsoft and had been there for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so I jumped on this thinking of Satya Nadella, thinking, hey, you've seen a lot of transition in the culture as an employee there. Am I correct? And what have you seen? And basically she goes, it went from a place that was very cutthroat, you know, like just drive, all about the numbers and a lot of uncertainty happening with the team, to this new CEO comes in at the time, who's not new anymore, being Satya Nadella, and completely shifted the culture. So Microsoft, as everyone knows, is, you know, one of the most successful companies ever, and then had lost its way. And then 10 years ago, when Satya came in to take the helm as the leader, he really took a people-centric approach. And now he's adjusted the culture. He's created basically something like moving the Titanic is now actually more agile and flexible than ever before. And so this is a great case study of how do you shift a culture and a company in today's world that's been around for a long time. And that Microsoft is a force right now.
Yeah, I mean, he has such an incredible track record. I mean, you look at everything that's happened. I was just looking that on the internet here, quick search for Satya Nadella's work. So it looks like he succeeded Steve Ballmer in 2014.
Yep.
And, you know, he's been doing amazing things ever since. I mean, I'm thinking about like the whole Xbox gaming, revolution. I'm thinking about the acquisition of LinkedIn. I'm thinking about, you know, just the way he's transformed the company, responded to AI that's been in the news lately. I mean, just his vision and leadership has been unprecedented.
Yeah, and obviously, OpenAI, ChatGPT, OpenAI, and what's happening there, and how he got involved with the firing of Sam, right? That came out of nowhere. He didn't even know about it. And Microsoft's a major investor. And he actually came in and stabilized that whole thing over, I don't know, a 72-hour period. It was pretty impressive what he did there. You know, I think your example of those acquisitions and OpenAI being not an acquisition, but more of a major investor, it again speaks to the new attitude in terms of how they're going to approach this and they're going to evolve. Again, he's known as a people-centric leader. In fact, I've met a few times. I don't know him well, but Dr. Michael Gervais is the sports psychologist for the Seattle Seahawks. He also is helping Microsoft rebuild their culture from the ground up and really getting people to rethink things. So I just think his approach is even frame breaking, and maybe that's the engineer in him, because I think he's an engineer by trade early on in his career, and kind of taking that, well, if I re-engineer this a different way, you know, how will this work better in the future?
Yeah, and maybe this is the right time to also underscore something else that's pretty incredible that I think has been, you know, quietly or not quietly crept up, and no one's really paying attention to it, is all of these chief executive officers from India. I mean, I just pulled it up on the internet here, and
Pepsi is one, right?
I mean, there's just so many. Yes, the list includes CEOs of IBM, Google, YouTube, Adobe, PepsiCo, Microsoft, Palo Alto Networks, Micron Technologies, Arista Networks, World Bank, Starbucks, The Oregon Group, NetApp, VMware, Novartis, Vertex Pharma, Cadence, and many, many more. It's pretty incredible that, you know, India has become this place. It's like Notre Dame is like a quarterback factory. India has become this place there where they cultivate great leaders, CEOs, and oftentimes they'll come in and save a company or transform a company, like, you know, like Satya did with Steve Ballmer. Totally different personality. I mean, Steve was this like very outgoing, very outspoken cheerleader, you know, the opposite of Bill Gates, right? Where Bill is very introverted and he's the, you know, Ballmer was the cheerleader out there clapping and dancing and creating, you know, all this hype, and then succeeded by Satya, who's also a different, very different leader. But
it's true. You're right. They're kind of opposites.
Yeah.
And I wonder what it is about the culture of India and those that, because here's the thing. Satya is educated in his undergrad and MBA, I believe, in the United States. So educated here and has been living here for a long time. But yet there is something from the culture of India that is infused here, that there's got to be a common place that's really affecting the American businesses, the worldwide businesses, but coming from there. What do you think that India factory is all about?
I don't know. It's worth investigation. I mean, I just think it's a phenomenon. Like it's incredible. So there must be some like core tenets there built into the Indian culture, or maybe it's part of their education process. I'm not sure, but yeah, pretty phenomenal.
I had no idea until you brought up all those names that there were that many leaders taking over these major organizations from India. Mm-hmm. I've thought about, being a Canadian, why have so many Canadians done well in the U.S. and mostly in the arts, but also happening in business as well. And my hypothesis on this one is there is actually an investment from the government into the arts in terms of getting more people to experience it. But I think when it comes to leadership, there's also this general management approach where you're feeding off of the US's deep resources, and then figure out how do you make your little bit of resources work harder by feeding off of it. And I think that generalist approach, I think, is really bode well for leadership when you come down to the US and take over. But I don't know if that's the same with India. That's the thing. So I'm like, that's a hypothesis for Canada. I don't know than the India one.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's a whole future, you know, episode on its own to dig into.
I like it.
Why are they so successful? It's like they're doing something right.
Yeah. They're definitely doing something right. Teach us our friends in India, please.
Well, another good example of great leadership in a big company is, maybe let's talk about Brian Chesky and what he's done at Airbnb.
He's a phenomenal leader as well. Brian Chesky, he might be one of those leaders that so many people like have a desire to work with or for. Yeah, he's done some amazing things. So think about Airbnb and how Airbnb reinvented, I'll say the hotel side, the on hospitality, and how do people go and rent out their home? Like, it's kind of like the Uber scenario, right? I'm going to go use my car to go pick up strangers.
Yeah. Do you know how they got started? Do you know their origin story?
Actually, I don't know the actual origin story.
So if I'm remembering it correctly, it all kind of stemmed from Brian seeing an opportunity. I think it was the 2008 Democratic National Convention. And all these people were, you know, rushing into this, you know, area of that particular part of the country to come in for the convention. Mm-hmm. And there was not enough hotels. Mm-hmm. And so people started opening their house up, you know, for rental or for people to stay over. And he saw this as a business opportunity and kind of created like this basically makeshift, you know, service and helped get people into houses during that time and then turned it into a business and, you know, expanded the vision and formalized it and built this incredible website with one of the best user experiences and user interfaces that I've ever experienced. It's so easy and smooth to use, but it all got its start from seeing a need, people without housing, and then expanded that idea.
And then it exploded.
Yeah. Oh, but then, you know, he tried to get funding and everyone said, that's the worst idea I've ever heard.
Of course. Like, who's going to rent out their house for strangers to come live in it?
Right. Right.
And then of course now we're like, many people will.
Yeah.
I think what's amazing to me about Brian is he reinvents and creates a category basically. And then he's had to evolve it with many headwinds along the way. Whether it's COVID and what happened during the pandemic where no one was traveling, but then they were, but that really hurt his business clearly and the Airbnb business. I also think about the restrictions that municipalities have been putting on the business, almost like in trying to shut it down. And yet they continue to flex, be agile, find common ground, find different ways of getting there. Even I'll just share one other one. I think from a consumer perspective is, there were a lot of complaints and issues, and rightfully so, about you see this price of what you're going to get your Airbnb for, and then there's all these crazy service fees. And so he heard that. Maybe you could argue they were a little slow to react, but he heard that, and now they've shifted it so as you see all the price up front. Mm-hmm. So I think this is one of the most innovative businesses, not just how they start, but when you think about leadership, you need to be in today's world. You know, flexible, adaptable to new information, to adjusting to where the puck is going, if you will.
Yeah, and we should give some more credit to his co-founders, to also Joe Gebbia and Nathan, who are part of that co-founding team of three. But Brian becomes the spokesperson, right? Because I think that's just his ethos. He's also, I think, one of the instrumental people behind this whole Sam Altman thing, where he was representing Sam in the OpenAI discussion, you know, him getting ousted and then getting, you know, put back to where he was a confidant of Sam's. Do you know this story?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he's just one of these guys. And another story is how Airbnb had to cut loose almost 2,000 employees. And this was like, you know, during the pandemic when everything was coming unraveled. And what does he do? He then puts the feelers out to all of his executive friends in the CEO circles and says, these are great people. You know, we're just at a point where, you know, the environment's changed and we need to let people go, but I want to find a home for them. Can you help?
You know what's really cool about that? The ripple effect. When he did that, when Brian and the team at Airbnb said, basically, here's a list of folks. I know Peloton followed suit and did the same thing, mm-hmm. among many others. And so the ripple effect of like, well, if they're doing it, then we should do it. Even if they felt out of obligation, because someone else led the way, that ripple effect is so significant. Huge deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the equity that bought them, you know, probably when things came back, to be able to get some of those people back or at least attract new people, that's everything, right?
Absolutely. How you treat your people, for sure. Someone gave me advice early on in my career so when you think about you're going through your career path, and everyone thinks about what's my first 90 days and what's the impact I'm going to have. The most important thing you can do is not the first 90 days, although yes, it's important. It's always important. But how you leave a company is incredibly important because it's a pay it forward. So in this case, it wasn't necessarily how somebody's leaving. It's like, how are we helping you leave so that maybe if the future has our paths crossed again, you join us. So I think that's one of the most underestimated things of, you know, how do you take people, how do you take care of people upon exit? And I think also, folks, for those of you that are leaving, is think about how you're leaving a company, because it's your brand. It's brand you. And you need to think about that.
I have another question about that. So how transparent should a CEO be about how things really are in a company? I mean, it's almost like, you could have, if you're full transparency, you could have a run on the banks, right? Like where people get desperate and like, everyone either abandons ship or maybe they oust you because, you know, they want to try and, I mean, how do you handle that transparency?
Yeah. Well, obviously, if you're a public company, you have to be even more transparent than private. So just by regulation in itself. I would say this is I tend to opt for more transparency, but being consistent on it. So there's no surprises. So then we all own the solution to get it to a better place. But you're right. There are things that you don't want to cause. There's a fire in the theater shouting when we still have a chance to get the fire out. So I think you have to use some really fine judgment. You definitely want to share enough so nobody's completely in the dark. But if it's people focus on their circle of concern versus circle of control many times. And if you think it's going to distract them and knock them off their feet, then I think you need to figure out what information you need to give to move things forward and make sure that they're not surprised as things are going that way. But let's not make people scared either, because you have to lead with hope and possibility as to where you can take this. And you as a leader can do that. Sometimes your team can't see that, even if you tell them. So you've got to figure out, give them enough information. It's a fine balance. But at the same time, there's times to hold it back. You have to. And there's been many, many points in that. You know, let me give an example. We sold Noon Hydration to Nestle Health Science. And during the process, everyone knew that there was going to be a point where we would be sold. But until that sale happened, there was really an obligation legally that it had to be confidential. So when it happened, I don't think anyone was surprised. But when it happened, what was news to them is like, oh, it's Nestle? They didn't know that. But they knew there was a process in the works. And my whole thing was, don't get them to focus on that. So I was like, one, we could get acquired. Two, they decide we don't like the price is basically how I positioned it. So we're like, let's not sell. Or three, it could be a partial buy-in to the company. And so then all of a sudden became more ambiguous, which was all true. But the lead horse was somebody buying us, which is what happened. So again, give enough information so no one was surprised, but there's also information you need to hold back so that people aren't focused on the wrong thing.
Yeah. And I guess sometimes you have to make hard choices. I mean, I also think I'm pulling up here in the news, Spotify's Daniel Ek, right? Says Spotify shares closed up more than 7% Monday after music streaming service announced that they would cut 17% of their workforce. Ouch. 1,500 jobs right at Christmas. So that's a tough cut at a tough time.
Yeah, well, part of the thing on cuts is there's no right time. So there's no feel good moment. But I understand everything you're saying and agree, you know, of all times, do you need to do it at that moment? but it's year end, right? So they're focused on the financials. I think that's actually coming back to a fundamental issue here is we are treating people like a cost center, as opposed to they are a profit revenue center, because that's, it all comes down to people. So when we treat people like a cost center, we're basically cutting it like it's a widget and an inventory. And I think that's a big miss. You know, I think Elon, when he came in, when he acquired Twitter, he cleaned house, and I don't remember, did he get rid of over half the organization?
I think it's like 75%.
Yeah.
Just it's a ghost town now. But, you know, he would describe it as just the core essentials.
And here's the thing. So he cuts, as you said, 75% of the staff, and the end user, I'm not saying the people internally, but the end user didn't really notice much of a difference. So now you have other businesses looking at this going, all right, well, maybe we have to trim, if you will, it's a business term phrase, but trim the fat. And so maybe that's what's happening here is that I can do this without any recourse. Like we can actually do business as usual. Here's what I will say is business is cyclical, just like the economy is cyclical. You will go through good times and there will be recessions. And so what does tend to happen that I've seen many times over, both in my personal experience as well as observing others, is it's a little bit like an accordion, and it expands out. It's like, okay, we need to retrench, and then the accordion comes in. So there is a restructuring where people move on, for sure. It's going to happen. You can't always expand out. That accordion can only go so far. You got to contract a little bit to then expand further. And I think this is a good example of that.
Yeah. So Eck was quoted here, I think on CNN, saying, we are going to announce a significant strategy shift for the music streaming company. Economic growth has slowed dramatically and capital has been more expensive. I mean, it's sort of a canned answer.
Oh, totally.
But I mean, you know, we're going a different direction, Kevin. You know, it's like, I'm sorry to say we're going to have to let you go because we're going a different direction. It's like, that's super ambiguous, but it's a catch-all phrase for like, we don't have enough money to pay you, or we don't value you enough to keep you, so we've got to let you go. It's like one of those phrases.
Yeah. And although canned, it's not, and the reason why it is canned is it's not wrong. Like that's true. You know, capital is more expensive than what it was, as one of the sound bites within there.
Yeah.
So it's not wrong.
It's not untrue.
It's not untrue.
Yeah.
It's not untrue. But, you know, I will say, to me, the strategy is don't get over your skis and expand too fast. From a people perspective, make sure that you're almost backfilling as opposed to forward filling, where you're going out and leaning in and hiring all these people to anticipate the growth. I think which is harder to do what I'm saying in this case, but it's actually more pragmatic from a financial perspective, is how do you go and get the business growing and hire almost at that same pace or even a little behind? Again, that's tougher on the team, but if we are focused on our priorities and we're all collaborating together, I think you can do it.
What advice do you have for the team? If you're one of those 1,500 employees at Spotify that just got let go, how do you leverage that opportunity into your next one?
Well, I would say, first of all, coming from Spotify and in a tech background, you are incredibly marketable. I would argue that there's a lot of companies that want some of that magic. So I would put yourself out there. Meaning not just the typical way of resumes, submitting in, looking for roles, but build your network, right? I think you and I have talked about this when we've heard the saying, right? Your net worth is your network. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. I also think, you know, be out there and build your personal brand. Get out there and help contribute and add value with thoughts that are going through your mind, to be present, be relevant out there while you're getting there. But again, here's the thing. If you're part of the layoffs, as an example, restructuring from Spotify, there's going to be people that want the magic of Spotify. So you are highly marketable.
Yeah. My brain goes to write, you know, like, okay, so if Spotify's number one in the market, who's number two, who's number three? You go to those exactly. folks because they don't get as much love.
Yep.
You could probably at least have a better chance of getting a look there, but also kind of going off script and going non-endemic could be also a good move. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, like Spotify is this music tech company, like what other brands, and it's sort of like a lifestyle brand. I'm thinking like maybe a up and coming apparel brand or shoe brand or something that has a lot to do with music and culture and that kind of vibe, where a Spotify might be a great fit, even though it's not music or tech centric. It could be just part of the culture and vibe. So,
and it could go to many things, right? So tech crosses all different industries. So I agree with where you took it naturally as the adjacency. It could go to, you know, fast moving consumer packaged goods.
Or even a brand that's sort of sleepy and needs a lot of help.
True.
You know, like, let's go to hockey. I mean, there's a lot of cool hockey brands, people that make the sticks or make the gloves or, you know, and these are like legacy brands that have been doing this for like 100-something years. But like, you don't even know their names, at least I don't, because they're not sexy or, you know, they don't have this, you know, behind it. You know, it's like, you know, so maybe you could go there from a brand like Spotify and really pump some new life into these old blue chip or legacy brands and get them, you know, pumping again.
Well, exactly right. That's part of the magic of Spotify, right? And you've got that skill set, meaning if you're coming from there. And I agree. I love your idea of actually go to the unexpected sleepy brands and sleepy categories that need an injection of new life. I've been in some conversations with some companies that are stuck in their old ways. Like these companies have been around for a while and they're trying to think through, hey, what got us here won't get us there. Mm-hmm. And how do we reinvent ourselves? And technology is infusing everything. So I love your thinking there. I think the future is bright. If you've been truly, I know it doesn't feel that way for anyone that's been laid off, restructured from one of these big tech companies, you are way more marketable than you realize. Mm-hmm. You may not go to specifically another a tech company, but you can take that tech image and skills to somewhere else and make an impact even quicker.
Well, here's another specific idea. We've been talking about Levi's and the whole Levi's story. Maybe a Spotify person could jump into Levi's. Here's a brand, talk about legacy brand, blue chip brand.
Yes.
That needs new life breathed into it. The CEO of Levi's is in the news because he's quoted as saying his biggest mistake was not firing the wrong people fast enough. And I think he's quoted by saying, the easiest way to change the culture is to change the people. I had 11 direct reports in the first 18 months, 9 of them were gone, said Charles Berg, CEO of Levi Strauss. So, you know, here's someone who's trying to make change at the company, but still has a fundamental problem of their brand not being sort of in touch with what's popular right now.
Definitely a problem. Can I talk about the culture on this one, this move by the CEO from Levi's? 9 of 11 executives gone off the leadership team in 18 months. So think about the legacy knowledge, the institutional knowledge that's there that's now gone. I'm not suggesting you don't make any changes, just to be clear. But I think a wholesale change says to me, gosh, is something rotten to the core? At Levi's, I hope not. So I really challenge that mentality of cleaning house. That being said, there's a term that I heard Adam Grant say this one recently, and he called it cognitive entrenchment. Mm. And cognitive entrenchment basically means it's almost a situation of you have so much knowledge, you have too much knowledge, you have mastery in this situation that you can't let it go, or you don't even see your blind spots. We've always done it this way, as you and I talked about earlier.
Yeah, you're stuck in your old ways.
You're stuck in it, and you don't even know it. Like you're stuck in it. And so the only way to fix it or address it is to, you got to remove the person.
Clean house, yeah.
And unless they can show that they can be open to it. Usually what I would say is this. I would say that you, with a shift of a person or two, the others kind of get a wake up call and start to shift the way they're thinking. They're going, well, wait a minute, what can I learn from this? On that note, I was just thinking about this one. I don't think this was a conversation for us to have today, but it correlates to this one. And it's just so hot on my mind. And it's this, you know, a CEO gets rid of 9 of 11 executives, clean house. Another situation is changing the coach or a leader. Fire the leader, changes the company. And in the case of sports, the National Hockey League specifically, I think there's been 5 head coaches fired this year. And there's something known as the new coach bump. Mm-hmm. And the new coach bump basically means a new coach comes in and all of a sudden now you start winning. So
how does that happen? Why does that happen?
And I'm digging in to try to understand this, but I do have a couple of thoughts on this one of why I think it could happen. And because it's the same players, right? So in this case, the CEO says, I need to change the players. In the case of what's happening right now in the National Hockey League is it's actually the same players. They change the coach and they start winning. I can tell you that from an outsider view and everything I'm reading, it's not that the previous coach wasn't liked. In fact, in most cases, the players were fighting for their coach not to be fired.
Yeah, sure. And this is not one sport specific either. I mean, this is like across the board. You see this in soccer, football, right?
Correct.
National Football League. I mean, MLB, it's across the board, all sports.
All sports. And you could argue it happens in business too. And so when you think about it, you're like, why is it happening? And so what we say to our players, our teammates, has an impact. There's actually science behind the impact of like the whole motivational talk, the pep talk before, you know, in the locker room or whatever it might be. So back to our conversation of, you know, what do you hold back? What do you say? There is something about when you, there was actually a study done in, I think it was the University of Nipissing, which I believe is in Northern Canada. It was a elite hockey team. And they did this study to understand when you looked at video of a victory, your testosterone increased by 45%, if I remember correctly. And by the way, testosterone can then lead to this adrenaline rush and different things that can lead to performance. Not a bad thing for hockey. When you watched a video of when you lost, there was actually no change. It wasn't a decrease. It just didn't change. And so there's so many studies, back to your point on different sports, of what you say and how you talk to each other will have a direct implication as to how you perform. How this comes and correlates back in my mind to the coaches, maybe you're not hearing what the coach has to say anymore. And so you just needed a different framework and mindset, even though you didn't think you did. And a new coach comes in and it just shakes the way you're looking at it. And then they can get you to see, how can we win? And giving you hope and possibility, where when things are firings happening, things aren't going right. So you're focused on that. You are dwelling on it. It's the example is this is you look at things like almost like a microscope and you're looking very tight because when it gets tight, you're trying to hold on. Yet if you widen your view, all of a sudden it's much more calming and you can see possibility and hope. And I think the new coach bump, I believe, is that, because again, the players are the same. You can't change a system and processes in a day. You can't do it in a day. You can impact a little bit, but you can't change it in a day. But you can change a mindset pretty quickly and see what ends up happening. And then you start building and getting a systems approach.
I like that a lot. I just off the cuff have a different theory or idea. Maybe it's similar, but also a little bit different. And I'm just speaking from personal experience. So I remember when I played, and I was a 3-sport guy in high school. I played football, believe it or not, in spite of my size, baseball and soccer. I also wrestled a little bit, but I didn't keep up with wrestling. I was never the type that if the coach chewed me out or cracked the clipboard over my head or whatever the coaches did at the time.
I hope they didn't do that.
If you had a helmet on, they cracked the helmet right over here. Like, okay, damn it, whatever. You know, it's like, I never responded well to negativity. I would always sort of really have this deep-seated resentment, or I was kind of humiliated. That was the feeling I felt at the time. It didn't inspire me to get yelled at. On the flip side, if someone encouraged me and said, I believe in you, you got this. Hey, no problem. Shake it off. Like, man, I was so emboldened. I was so built up and bolstered. Like, I felt like I could conquer the world, even if I couldn't.
Yeah.
That's just how I reacted as a player. So I tend to think, based on that loose, unscientific theory, that certain players respond to certain coaches on a certain frequency. And that, you know, if you happen to have that team in place with that coach that has the frequency dialed into your players, then you have success. And I look at coaches like Pete Carroll, who have this reputation for being super positive, almost never negative. They're always, you know, playing music during practice. You know, he's got like uplifting music playing in the locker room all the time and like always encouraging. And then the contrast of that is like Bill Belichick, who is like, would whip you into shape and abuse you with words and even with actions. And, but you know, like, so you have two different kinds of players. You have like the Tom Brady's and the Gronks of the world saying, you know, I hated Belichick at the time, but I'm so glad that I played for Bill Belichick. They made me a better player. So it's like, it seems like different people respond to different stimulus, negative or positive. And so like, you just have to find that winning frequency for both the players and the coach.
I agree with you completely. And you're right. There's different wavelengths that we need at different times too, not just different people. So one of the things that I was thinking about as you were talking, I was thinking, how does Pete Carroll have such longevity, or Belichick up until, you know, last couple of years have been rough for them and the New England Patriots. And I think the same thing happens in business, is there are some leaders that continue to have the team flourish with longevity. And I think the way to get there is, I think, threefold. I think one, you need to constantly adjust your style to the individual and to where you are at that time. So you need to be predictable for sure. So you need to be consistent, but I also think you need to have the team expect things to be shaken up and trying different ways and different approaches. Two, I think you need to surround yourself with people that are different than you, as a leadership team. So those different styles, you can push and pull. You know, it's the whole good cop, bad cop scenario. So maybe Pete Carroll has some bad cops on his coaching staff, and that could be true. And I think I've experienced that both, you know, as one of the players on the team in business and in sports, but also as the leader, as the head coach. Mm-hmm. So I think that, the third one is about how do you really unleash and let the players and the team lead as well and be part of the solution. And so then that the change and the shift comes from almost within, almost like a bottom up approach. So again, three different ways to approach this. People do react differently. I agree that most people don't actually respond well to the negative feedback. Again, the studies would suggest that it actually is counterproductive. It rarely results in better performance. So it makes sense of how you reacted.
The other thing that's striking, or maybe is worth underscoring, is, do you know how old Pete Carroll is?
I think I do, actually.
Yeah.
He's 71.
72. Belichick is 71, almost 72.
Okay.
So, you know, they're like, you think about, you know, black cowboy hat, white cowboy hat, you know, like they're the same person on opposite coasts, right?
Yep.
And there's talk of having Belichick come to the Chargers to reinvigorate that team. And it's amazing how it's almost like, you know, what have you done for me lately, right? Like, here's Belichick, one of the winningest coaches in NFL history. And, you know, the era of Tom Brady is over. And so his time at New England might be over as well. There's a Chargers team that's stacked with Justin Herbert, arguably the new Tom Brady, or at least trying to step into his shoes, a Tom Brady-like quarterback, you know, young, talented, and a stacked team with great receivers, running backs. You know, they have a lot going for them. They don't have a coach right now, so they're a little bit with, you know, like a ship without a rudder, right? And so maybe Belichick will come in and and Belichick that team, you know, into victory, where whoever was previously there couldn't do. And I'm not just talking about the coaches just let go, but like the San Diego Chargers and now the new Los Angeles Chargers have had a hard time historically, even with great players, getting to the Super Bowl. So who knows what'll happen. The other two coaches that I thought with a lot of life experience, you have Nick Saban, who is the Alabama head coach.
Yep. Amazing. And
you talked about players adapting to a coach's style or a coach adapting to the player style. I don't know which one is better, but I also thought of John Wooden, you know, the legendary basketball coach. And one of the stories I remember hearing, I can't remember. I think it might've been like, I might get this wrong, so don't hold me to it. But I think it was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar who played for John Wooden at UCLA. And Kareem, you know, was this amazing player. But I think one of the things that John Wooden insisted is that you learn how to tie your shoes correctly. And he said that, you know, if you learn to put on your socks properly and your shoes properly, like that was everything. And I think Kareem gave him some pushback on that. It's like, come on, coach, like I'm a, you know, All-American player. I don't need to conform to your style. But he was a stickler for some of these really small detailed things. And he would argue, like, if your sock was bunched up too much in the front, it would give you blisters on your feet. And if you tied your shoes incorrectly, they would either come loose and you would, you know, get some sort of foot problem or ankle problem. And so he was focused on these little tiny details in order to get big picture results.
That is fascinating. I have not heard that story. I didn't expect it to go there, like meaning the shoes. I have been thinking a lot about the rituals, habits, and practices of sports and how that applies to business. And that this reminds me of it, to your point of you've got to do some of the fundamentals. This one's really fundamental, like putting on your shoes properly and socks. But I do think there's something to be said of it. It's boring stuff, but you've got to repeat so it becomes supernatural and secondhand to you doing it. I love that story though. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is quite the good human too. So it's a really cool one.
The other thing that popped in my brain is it must be challenging for some of these amazingly talented and successful coaches. What was the term to not get entrenched? It was cognitive
entrenchment.
So there must be a tremendous amount of cognitive entrenchment. Let's say Bill Belichick goes from Patriots to the Chargers. He's going to bring all that with him, right? He's got all that baggage and all that experience. He's like, I know how to win games. I know how to win Super Bowls. I know how to transform teams. But at the same time, he's got to be flexible enough to be this old dog that can be taught new tricks.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, how do you balance that? How do you reconcile that as a leader? You know, you've been there. You've been a CEO, jumped into a new company, a new culture.
Yeah, I would say, on the case of if the Bill Belichick, the old guy coming in doing new tricks, I actually think he could probably come in and do his old tricks and make it work for a period of time. And that period of time, by the way, could be a couple of years, but then they get kind of old and tired and you need to have a new bag of tricks. I think for me, the way I come in is I tend to come in and say, what's working? That's where I start always from the place of what's working. Because if it's so much easier to amplify strengths than it is to fix your issues. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying don't fix the issues, to be clear. But I am saying start with your strengths. And that's where you start to learn new tricks, if you will, because you're like, whoa, you guys do that's good. Okay, how do we do more of that? How do we amplify that?
Well, you also have a coach, you know, going back to John Wooden, here's a coach that coached multiple teams. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what's the common denominator in all our success? Well, it's John Wooden, right? So it's like,
yeah,
if you follow John's process, same thing with Nick Saban. You know, Nick has coached all these teams throughout the years, you know, he has a process.
You know, the thing about college football and using those two examples of Saban and Wooden is the players are shifting and changing every 4 years, right? Well, every year, but you have a new class coming in. Mm-hmm. And I'm not there are changes in pro sports, but the careers tend to go with the key players longer. And so I actually think it's probably harder to be the pro coach and keep things changing, adjusting, and growing. Because once you get stuck in this way of doing things, it's hard to shift. And I think there's a big difference, which is what also is interesting about Pete Carroll, because he actually did it very successfully at USC in college. And is, I think, the only one to win a national championship, I think, at the college level and the pro level. And he's done it at the pro level. And now I think the Seahawks have made the playoffs 11 years since he's been there.
Yeah. And Pete couldn't get it done at New England. He was there before Belichick.
Yes, true. That's true.
Interesting. You know, it's just time and place or time.
Maybe you needed time in the pro circuit to understand. And then, okay, hold on. How do I try this? I think Pete Carroll does a nice job of always reinventing himself, though.
There's just so many variables, right? But it's, you know, it's what you're up against when you become, you know, an executive and you're jumping in to a new environment. You've got to, I guess, bring a fair amount of your processes that you know are proven, but also be flexible enough to not be entrenched in your thinking and be able to be fluid and adapt to your new team.
I think you have to go in, you're right. Like anytime I've gone into my newest and latest assignment in a leadership role, I have a hypothesis as to what we want to do. However, not only do I go in with strengths, you need to go in listening. You really, really have to listen. People need to feel heard and feel like they matter. And when you do that, then you're starting to build trust, and you start to build trust, then you build bonding, and then bonding leads to relationships and builds the culture.
I'm just wondering too, taking this one step further, how does this advice apply to nonprofits?
In my mind, I actually think it's very similar. So nonprofits, by nature, the name is very apologetic. Nonprofit. Okay. It's a nonprofit from a regulation perspective, right? And it's, as a legal entity, I get that. Let's shift the conversation and call it a for-impact organization. And if you think about it, a for-impact organization can be defined as a nonprofit, or it could be a for-profit organization. And I think actually there's more similar than not. And I personally believe that that's a paradigm shift that needs to happen with the nonprofit world. There's a lot of great people and a lot of great organizations in that world. Yet I still think they're very apologetic and thinking like that, and not thinking as a for-impact organization and thinking, how would a business do this, a for-profit business, to amplify what we're doing? Sometimes it almost feels like you're holding on to what you've got as opposed to focusing on the growing the pie. Not always. I'm not suggesting that, but I see it a lot in nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. I think of a company like Charity Water. Do you know about Charity Water?
Is Charity Water a nonprofit? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because obviously, you know, being in the hydration business, I believe, don't they have a ready to drink bottled water? Am I right or wrong on that?
Well, I've sat down and I've met Scott Harrison and sat down with him and heard his story many times. It's been a while since I had him on my podcast, but his story was pretty incredible. It just comes to mind. We're talking about cognitive entrenchment and doing things the way we've always done them. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily always mean it's the best path, right? Like breaking the status quo can be a good thing when the status quo isn't working.
Correct.
And for Scott's purpose in Charity Water, like the way to raise funds for his cause was not working. So he did a very, you know, off the beaten path approach. And that's kind of what got me thinking about, does your advice apply to nonprofits the same way? And it seems like it does. I just think maybe you have some other parameters, like you have board members and other people who can be roadblocks. And so what do you do about that? Do you reset the board? How do you get things done in a very new way if you're already entrenched?
Well, I think that would happen in a for-impact business too. So I agree with you, right? So what can happen in the nonprofit world is you have a board that everyone's passionate about the cause, but they also might have some personal agendas with that and how they tie into it because it's a very donor base. Yet on smaller companies, the investors a lot of times are on the board as well. That's why I'm like, well, there can be some parallels here, different agendas. I think the one thing about Four Business is the unifying force is the bottom line. And I think for nonprofits, it's about the mission is always at the forefront. So for me, when I'm running a business, I was always trying to make the mission at the forefront, even with our investors. What is the mission? What's the future state of the world we're trying to create? But I do agree. I'd love to hear more, and we can do this offline, on Charity Waters. What were they doing and how do they shift? And I do think that's important. I think if you keep trying to do the same thing and it's not working, right, that's the definition of insanity if you're expecting a different result. You know, we just talked about Levi's, and maybe they did need it. They need a drastic change. So, the Charity Waters sounds really interesting to me as a case study.
Okay, so on the impact side, let's look at what's in the news right now about Harvard University. They've got a big problem. Their university president is accused of plagiarism, and the accusation is that she, you know, lied and basically plagiarized several different papers in order to earn that spot. And now it seems like she refuses to resign. What is your advice there when you're in that situation, either, you know, on the Harvard side? This is a leadership decision. We were talking off camera a little bit about George Santos, politician problems.
Exactly.
That one seems a little bit more obvious, but how about if you're the Harvard University president?
Well, there is a process to go through, you know, determining whether someone was guilty of this or not, right? So if they're in denial and they're saying I didn't, it can be a he said, she said scenario. However, there is a process, pretty diligent process from what I understand. And I think they can pretty much identify whether or not plagiarism happened. So assuming, and Harvard's pretty reputable school, call me crazy.
Yeah. Well, let's look at this from the president's side, you know, as a leader.
Okay.
She's refusing to step down, even if the accusations are true.
Yeah.
And then let's look at it from the, you know, the Harvard brand university side, from a leadership position. How do you recover from something like this? I mean, please, you know, let's weigh in both sides.
Well, so I was, thank you for that. That's a good clarity. So I was teeing up to take it from the Harvard brand side, where it's going, they've got a process on what to do here. So therefore you're likely going to determine that she plagiarized. Therefore you have to remove them.
Yeah.
So that's what, so to your point on the part two, I actually went with part two first on the brand side. This is a really interesting one too, right? So assuming she's guilty, this is where it becomes a little bit gray, because she's, I think, saying she's not, I didn't do it, I'm assuming.
Yeah. So these are all alleged,
right,
accusations, and, you know, we don't know the facts, until the facts come out, you know.
I think one of the big challenges we have in society today can be used as this as an example of when I'm wrong, assuming the alleged of she plagiarized is actually true. This doubling down of I'm right, you're wrong, and no, or I'm not leaving is, we have lost our way. And I think it's really, really bad for society in general. So this is one example of what's happening in many cases. The George Santos is, like you said, is another one where he kept on doubling down. Or he's like, that's not really an issue. Like, that is that going to be the next argument? Well, I didn't. You know, and is plagiarism really that bad? Like, are you quoting people all the time when you speak? Sure.
It's bad if you're a university president.
Of course. Of course. I'm not defending it, to be clear.
It's on the nose. I mean,
you're right.
You're going to kick your own students out. You've got to.
And that's why I'm like, it's so ridiculous. I'm like, is that what's going to be said? Like, and that's what I feel like we've got to, this whole doubling down versus, you know, I admit my mistake and I need to step out of the way to move on is the right thing to do. You know, there's some traits of leaders that I was noting down, thinking about this one. Traits of leaders, right? One, are you an energy giver or are you an energy taker, right? So basically think servant leadership. There's one. Two, do you have humility in terms of how you approach things? And so there's a confident humility, right? You need both, but you have to have this humility to know that there's a willingness that you may not know everything. Then there's integrity. So, and like, I feel like these fundamentals I'm thinking about for this Harvard professor is like, it's based on what's alleged, it feels like she's countered all this. Integrity, we all believe we have integrity. We all like want to feel that. That's why we don't want to be seen as hypocritical. So if you then find out you're wrong, right, then what do? You're like, I can't admit that now because then I'm a hypocrite. But here's the thing. I think the answer is actually how you build integrity, how you be an energy giver and servant leader. You go, I hear you. I'm in the wrong in most situations. I'm in the wrong. And let it take its course, like get out of the way and have that humility to do that for the greater good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's bring it back to team sports and being a good team member. Your friend of mine, Russ Wilson. So he's back in the news, being asked to delay his payment and push it into next year. Shohei Ohtani is famously in the news, just joined the Dodgers. A ridiculous, I think, $700 million contract in all.
Yeah.
But he's deferring the income over like 10-year period. And so he's taking it in more bite-sized chunks so that the Dodgers can recruit. And they just brought in that amazing pitcher, Yamamoto, I think his name is. Mm-hmm. They're going to be a force. But yet, you know, Shohei is coming off as a real team player by deferring his income and not being a prima donna and trying to take $700 million all at once.
Yep.
So that his team can build and bring in the players that they need to win games. Contrast that with what's happening with Russ Wilson. Mm-hmm. Denver has asked him to forego his salary in the way it's been contracted, but he's refused, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So, at the timing here we are right now, Russell has been told he's going to be benched. And what's come out is, you know, a few weeks earlier when he won a football game, they asked him to see if he would defer payment. And if he didn't, there was, in fairness to Russell, I have empathy for him too, as it was more of an ultimatum. It's like, do this or we'll bench you.
Right.
And so it's not, I actually think both sides have some, have a case to be made. At the same time, you know, Russell's actually legally, so remember we talk about doing the right thing versus doing things right. When you think of doing things right, Russell is actually correct here, meaning it's his contract. That's what they both agreed to do. Mm-hmm. So if it's going outside the contract, you can't have an expectation of that. You can ask, that's fine for Denver to ask that, but you can't expect it. Now, if I'm Russell, I'm like, okay, again, I don't know his financial situation and if he's outspending his means, which would be, wow, that would be a wild story.
There's no way. There's no way.
I don't expect between the two of them that's happening.
Yeah.
That being said, I don't know why you would go, although this isn't the doing things right, to do the right thing, I would, if I were Russell Wilson, I believe I would, is let's defer payment, back to your point. I'll get the money so we can get more players in so we can win. By the way, that helps me. That helps brand Russell. However, there's got to be things we don't know. So I think there's a real miss here, I think, on the Denver Broncos. I think there's a real miss on Russell Wilson based on what I'm hearing. I also have a guilt. You know what my guilt feeling is? My guilt feeling is this. When Russell, so I'm a Seattle Seahawks fan, and when Russell Wilson requested a trade to leave
the Seahawks, I know where you're going with this.
I was so annoyed. And then I heard that he wouldn't even give his cell phone out to his teammates from a Richard Sherman and Marshawn Lynch interview. When I heard that, I'm like, I wanted him to fail, which I don't. I feel really bad and a lot of guilt for feeling that. I really wanted him to fail, and he failed last year. I felt really good about him failing. And then he started off the year failing again. And there was a point where I'm just like, when he started to win, I actually go, why am I wanting him to fail? That's not right. That's not right. Like, I think he's a good person overall.
I've met him. He is a good person. Yeah. The short time I got to spend with him, super good vibes.
I get
the real deal. Yeah.
Maybe he's lost his way or whatnot, and it's got a little too surface level for some people. I don't agree with the whole teammate cell phone thing. That being said, you know what? I want him to do well. Yeah. And again, if I were to advise, or if I were in his position, I think I would have deferred.
Yeah, me too. I think, you know, listen, Rocky Balboa lost his way too, right? He lost the eye of the tiger. and he got his ass kicked by Clubber Lane, right?
There you go.
He had to go back to basics. Maybe that's what Russ is going through a little bit. Who knows? But yeah, it doesn't seem fair. Like, the approach that Denver took seems like the wrong approach. To try and pressure someone or guilt them or shame them into complicity. I mean, it seems like it was a control move, and it backfired because Russ just said no. But they maybe assumed that because he's maybe not been in the greatest favor of his teammates, that this could be an opportunity for him to be the hero, but they went about it the wrong way.
Yep.
And then Russ, you know, with an opportunity to be the hero or to do something that's not selfish, more being a good teammate than a single solo player, he sort of missed the opportunity. But at the same time, you know, I do see your point. Like, contractually, he has the right to refuse that. I mean, I would be pissed if I was being pressured to do whatever, even if it was, quote, the right thing. Double miss on both parts, for sure.
And think about, what does this mean for the players that are there? Whether they like Russell or not, they probably don't appreciate how the coach has been treating him and talking about him. And publicly, like, you know, yelling at him. Like, it's pretty crazy. I think there's a real culture issue happening and brewing, and it's not Russell. I think Russell is not part of the solution. I think it's now, that's a toxic environment to be in. So good luck on attracting talent is my thought. Good ownership there. The Walton family are good, but from what I understand. But I think this is really a toxic environment from what I can see.
All right, this is a lot of food for thought. Let's wrap up this episode.
Yeah, and before we wrap up, I do want to say one observation that I just want to share is this, is there's the Russell Wilson, there's the head coaches firing the coach. And I feel like what really struck me was, my favorite team in the NHL is the Ottawa Senators, and their coach, DJ, was fired 2 weeks ago. By the way, it was probably the right call based on what was happening from performance. That's not my issue. My concern is societal, is there's this very aggressive in the virtual world happening. Here is a good example that's happening beyond that, where people are on the attack. It's almost like they're searching for blood. Like, I'm going to keep going, fire the coach.
Well, it's kill or be killed. There's cancel culture, and then there's kill or be killed.
100%.
Yeah.
Here's what I think people aren't thinking about. There's the coach, but then there's the coach's kids, the coach's wife. They're seeing all of this. They're hearing the chants in the stadiums. And that's just a stadium. We're in the arena of social media. It's happening there. And my one thing that I just wanted to leave on this podcast today was, I purposely talked about Russell the way I did. I conveyed where I feel guilty of where I wasn't hoping for him. But what I would say is, listen, publicly, you can give people feedback. That's fine. But going on the attack is counterintuitive to the overall culture that we're all in. And so I think these are microcosms of a bigger issue that's happening. And it's magnified in sports because of the spotlight on it. I think this is in the social media world. People are, you know, on the hunt to try to take you down. And I don't think it's good for you. I don't think it's good for me or us and then all of us together. So I wanted to leave on that note because that's one that really has hit me hard. Okay. On a happier note, it was super fun conversation regardless. And hopefully all of you got some value out of this. So that's it for today. It was a great episode. Tune in for the next one, and we'll see you soon. Okay, team, let's bring it in. Hopefully you take away something today that you're able to reapply to your world. The purpose and intention of this pod is simply to give you the tools to excel both individually and as a team. Let's be crystal clear. Life is a team sport. This applies to the game of life, business, and in sports. I've said this before, there really is an I in team. I was born and raised in Canada, and the French translation for team there is équipe. So yes, literally, there is an I in équipe, and therefore, the meaning of team. It starts with the individual. That's you and me. We flourish with how we manifest our need to be interconnected. All this leading to imagining a future state of the world we want to create. And we will. So that's all for today. I would love to hear from each and every one of you, or any one of you. So you can find me at, let me know what you're thinking, on Instagram or Twitter, or known, otherwise known as X today, at the handle clean_lantern. That's clean_lantern. Fire away. And one last request, if I may, and if you feel so compelled, please feel free to leave a review on wherever you listen to your podcasts, and feel free to share as well. Thank you.